Okay, good morning to everyone. Rochala Mazinim. Yeah, let me just close the curtain over here. A little more quiet. I did. Oh, we read this week the Sedra of Chukas, which is a very rich Sedra with diverse topics. Very interesting. I want to look at some of the Midrashim on the Sedra, some that comment directly on the matters in the Sedra, and others that take up other areas that are worthy of thought and analysis. So, of course, the parsha starts with the mitzvah of Par Aduma. The Par Aduma, the red heifer, is what's brought as part of the rite through which people who are Tamei Meis became impure through contact with a corpse. They become purified for a variety of uses. And it's the classic chok in the Torah. Zos chukas ha-Torah asher tzivah Hashem le'mor. This is the statute, the chok of the Torah that God commanded. So what's a chok? How do we popularly understand a chok?
Something
has no rhyme or reason, just accept, right? It's partially true. The fact is there can't be anything in the Torah that has no rhyme or reason, because then it wouldn't make any sense to us. We wouldn't gain anything from it. So no mitzvah can be completely irrational or illogical, but the difference between a chok and, say, a mishpat is that a mishpat is something that we understand both the reason for as well as how the details further the reason, promote the reason. So, for example, it's a chok, it's a mishpat not to steal. To understand all the various details and laws of stealing, how they engender the basic concept. With a chok, it's different. A chok, we could know the general theme or the idea, the tam that we're trying to understand that helps us understand the mitzvah and come close to Hashem. But we can't understand the details of the mitzvah, how they promote that. Why, for example, the parah must be aduma and not black or brown or anything else. And why specific items are used. We could speculate, but we can't know with any certainty why that is. So that's a chok, how the particulars fit into the scheme. Why this detail, not some other detail, that is beyond us. So that becomes a mystery. Now look at the Medrash in number one. Zos chukas ha-Torah, ze she'omar kosov. This is what the Pasuk meant in Iyov when it said, mi tein tahor mi tamei lo echad. Who is it that can bring out the pure from the impure, lo echad, isn't it the one? And the Medrash explains, Kigon Avraham Miterach. Warning. Kigon Avraham Miterach. Avram came from Terach. Avram was Tahar. Terach was Tameh. Chizkiah me'Achaz. Chizkiah Melech was a righteous king. Came from Achaz. His father was wicked. Yoshiyahu, same thing. Me'Amon. Amon was a wicked king. Yoshiyahu was a tzaddik. Mordechai, Mishimi. That's not direct. I mean, it's direct, but it's not immediate. Shimi ben Gera was the one who cursed David. And if the Megillah says he was the ancestor, one of the ancestors of Mordechai. So again, you had Tahar coming from Tameh. Yisrael me'umos ha'olam, the Jewish people from the nations of the world. Who extracted this one nation? God. Olam haba me'olam hazeh, the world to come, which is completely Tahar, all good, from this world, where there's a lot of impurity, a lot of things that are not good. Mi'osa kein, who made this? Mi'tziva kein, who commanded it? Mi'gazar kein, who decreed that such a thing is possible to take out Tahar from Tameh? Lo yichido shel olam, wasn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu who did that? All right, so what exactly does this mean? So in context, I think it means that just like there's an element of the mysterious in a chok, there are parts of a chok that we can't understand. Again, in terms of the details, so too, if you take just one idea, how to raise children, right? How to reproduce in our children what we want from them. So usually the good will produce the good, and usually the bad will produce the bad. But it's not always true. Mi yitein tahor mi tamei. So what then is the secret of extracting the pure from the impure? Lo echad, isn't that God? In other words, there is an element of the mystery involved. It's not fully explicable. Why it is in a particular case, let's say parents that are not part of the Torah world, but nonetheless the children come back, who knows? And you have all these examples. Avram from Terach, Hizkiah from Achaz, Yoshiah from Ammon, Mordechai ben Shimi. This, of course, on some level is a discourse on Yichus, right? That ultimately it doesn't really matter, that no one is necessarily limited or constricted by their origins, by their parentage or grandparentage. Everyone makes their own choices. Of course, there are certain influences that you have to overcome, maybe more difficult for some, easier for others, but nonetheless, there are no absolutes. What is this from? It's from the Michido Shel Olam. It's from the way God created the world. God created the world in such a way that even Torah can come from Tame. Could use the example that Chazal used also of Rivka from Besuel. Yeah, he was a Rasha, she was a Tzedekes. So you see, they both exist. All this is good. The first four relate to people. Yisrael me'umo sa'olam, so what's that? That's not a question of parentage. That means in a world where tuma has a natural advantage over tahara, impurity, vulgarity has a natural advantage over purity, nonetheless, there can be people who are, in essence, devoted to the pursuit of virtue. Such a thing is possible. It's possible because Yechido Sha'ol HaKadosh Baruch Hu decreed it like that, and so too in terms of creation itself. You can have an existence that's all good, an existence of the soul, Olam Haba, and that becomes an extension, of course, qualitatively different, but an extension of this world as well. So this world, Olam Hazeh, which can be so overcome with problems and sorrows and evil, nonetheless, the Olam Haba, the world to come, is a natural extension of that. We always look at Olam Haba as the world to come, the world after death. The Ramban actually saw it as this world, the world of Yemos HaMashiach, meaning the world to come, there's Zeh, now, this, and Haba, it comes, it's the successor to this world, which in terms of the Medrash makes it even clearer, because it's just the world, there is a possibility the world can reach a stage of goodness, as far-fetched as it seems to us now. The Kol Simcha says here, why not the reverse? Why don't do we ever say that you could have a Tameh from Tahar, that something impure can come from pure? Yes, but why isn't it mentioned then? Why only this with Tahar Mitameh? Because, so Kol Simcha writes, and this is in the Medrash HaMavuar, that it all comes down to Bechira. The Tahar, in a sense, Tameh can produce the Tahar, because there's always going to be some element in the Tameh that lends itself to good as well, that the offspring can pick up on. But Tameh Mitahar is an act of Bechira, always comes down to choice. So it's not that necessarily that the offspring saw something improper in a parent that was otherwise good and therefore latched upon that. If that's what he does, then that's his choice. He has the right to see what's bad and decide accordingly, although, of course, he's much better off looking at the general picture, seeing the good and following in the footsteps of the good.
I always have a question.
Yes.
If we have choice, like if we can choose, but yet we know that, well, I feel like everything is from Hashem, so like, is it sort of all sort of pre-planned and what we choose?
Right, so what the conflict between predestination and free will, right, that's a very famous question. That's asked in Rishonim, the Ram discussed it at length, but the simple answer, which is actually, I think answers the question entirely. It's a pella that people don't pick up on this. This I heard from my Rebbe. The answer is, like the Beis Halevi said, that we have complete free choice. But God's knowledge of our free choice does not impinge on our decisions. Why is that? Because ki lo machsho osai machsho osaychem, God's thought processes, God's epistemology, so to speak, is not ours. We live in a world of cause and effect. There's a cause and there's an effect, and one follows. And we understand the world by looking at cause and effect. So therefore, from our perspective, in our world of cause and effect, we would think that if God knows, that's a cause, and because his knowledge is absolute, he's omniscient, so that cause must necessarily produce this effect. God's epistemology, God's thought process, is not dependent on cause and effect. So therefore, he may know something's going to happen, but nonetheless, that's not a cause and effect, because that knowledge is completely different. Can we relate to that knowledge? No, not entirely, because it's different from our ken. Although I must say that, give you an analogy and you'll see what it means. Let's say you know, let's say there's a sidewalk, right? And there's a covering on the sidewalk that's covering a pit, a hole, let's say 3 feet deep. And you know that people walking on that are going to, unless something happens, unless they're warned, they're going to walk right into the hole because they can't know otherwise. You could be watching that from a window, and a guy's a yard away, and you can know that he's going to go in. And sure enough, he goes in, but your knowledge does not cause him to go in. That's God's knowledge. Because there's no cause and effect between your knowledge
but
and what happened.
He doesn't have choice because he doesn't know the ramifications.
What's that?
The man who's
well, he has a choice. He could see maybe the.
It.
Yeah, he could see maybe it's a little different.
No, but if you just see something covered, like just a hole covered,
right.
You would think the person would walk around it.
Maybe yes, but let's say it's the same color as.
But then he really didn't have choice. It was.
I understand, but my point is that the fact that you know something's going to happen is not necessarily causing it to happen, because people do have their free choice, okay?
But I always think that God has a plan, like there's a plan for us.
Right, so God does have a plan, that's true. It doesn't mean the plan extends to every individual, except in a general sense. All right, it could be, in terms of tzaddikim, righteous people, that there's a specific plan for them. Whether there's a specific plan for every individual, that the Rishonim debate, whether that's true or not. The Rambam didn't accept it, others did accept it, but certainly if a person wants to live his life or her life, think that God has a plan, go out and find the plan, and then bring it to fruition.
Leads you in the way you want.
What's that?
You know that expression, you're led in the way you want.
So that's correct, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a specific plan.
Right.
Well, it means God's not going to interfere. So notice, it's written in a neutral sense. The route you want to take, that's through God will help you take. That's your choice. So if you want to be righteous, so God will find you avenues to express your righteousness. Person wants to be Baal Teshuva, so God gives opportunities as well. Person wants to be sinful, so many opportunities will present itself to him also. Yes?
No, what I was going to say is that it's true. Like, if you want to do something, God might send you all these opportunities, but a person could choose to not
accept them.
That's
correct.
That's
like the
choice.
Joke with the guy that's drowning, right?
Yes, that's
and
right.
The
helicopter, the boat, right, that's correct.
Where's God?
That's correct.
No, but if something, if a mishap befalls you,
yes.
Yes,
again, the Rishonim differ whether that's in fact so, but no doubt a person out of humility can say that I have to examine my ways and do tshuva, come closer to God. So that's an entirely proper approach, because that's just methodologically it's a good approach, whether in fact it's based in reality or not. You know, sometimes things just happen. But yes, but again, it's not a necessary, it's not an intrinsic belief to Judaism. Going to some, there's no doubt in the Hasidic world are much more open to that type of notion that God controls or masterminding every single event that happens in a person's life. A lot of Rishonim didn't think that. The Rambam certainly explicitly rejects that notion. He says tzaddikim, yes. Klal Yisrael as a nation, yes. And you could have different individuals who, for whatever reason, God instills in them certain ideas in order to effect his will. But as a general rule, no. Some extend it to everything, right? And you have statements in the Gemara like this, but the Rambam says, for example, the Mohr explicitly, to think that God decrees that this bird should eat this worm, he doesn't accept that at all.
All right, possible,
but people, I saw that people believe that, but the Rambam didn't accept it. Okay, one other point on this medrash that's very interesting. That's in the Michtav Meliyahu. He says here, he quotes it here, that he says there are two different ways in service of Hashem. So what does it mean, mi tein tahar mi tamei? How do you extract the pure from the impure? So he said there are two different methods in divine service. One can be a kovesh es yitzro, that is, you could overcome your nature, overcome it, fight against tendencies, and that way you won't sin. Or you can transform the ra into tov, that is to say, rechannel the energy, not suppress it, not control it, but actually redirect it. So Rav Dessler said the Derech Hashem is to find the tov in the ra. To find the tov in the ra, not just to suppress it, keep it down, but rather take what's not good and make it into something good. And through that, in fact, is that testifies to the notion of Achdus Hashem. God's unity means that God has the capacity to unite disparate, even antagonistic elements of our nature and of the world and everything in it in order to harmonize it, okay? Only God can harmonize Or V'choshech, Kodesh V'chol, even Yisrael V'amin. So there's a Havdalah, but ultimately there'll be this type of amalgam as well. Now, that being said, this is actually the middle of an essay that I looked at this morning. Very interesting one. It's in the fourth chalik of Michta Melio, called Torah Tevolin. Torah is a spice. And it's based on the Gemara that says that the Torah for some people is a spice, others it's a poison. All right, so how could that be? How could Torah be poison for some people and a spice, in other contexts, some chaim for someone else? So he mentions a very interesting area that we should think about, just a digression that's very valuable in terms of our own Avodas Hashem. He says that one of the essential characteristics that we have is the anochiyut, that we have, our ego, our sense of self. And our sense of self, the notion that we exist, that we recognize, we feel ourselves to be independent and special beings, like every child is told today they're special. Of course, if everyone is special, no one is special, but we don't think that far. But every person feels that he's a separate element. It's very deep, it's very innate. It's really the first sense that we have about ourselves. What's the first sensation an infant has of the world? Probably so, but that's a sense of self, that the world revolves around him or her, right? Child cries, doesn't care what time of night or day it is, what the parent otherwise wants to do. The child has needs. And a child grows up very narcissistic. That's why we will experience this. A child is like a year and a half, 2 years old, and they get a toy, right? And they're playing with another child, and the other child takes their toy. Whoa, that's mine. And they take it back because they haven't learned the notion of sharing. That has to happen over time, if indeed it happens at all. So that sense of the anochi fills a person's approach to reality. In fact, it governs a person's approach to reality, and as life goes on, it gets stronger and stronger. As an adult, what we then feel is in terms of kavod, that our sense of self, our anochiyut, our ego, is ratified if others pay us honor. Even, he says, in one of the sins that the Talmud mentions, l'skabed b'klon chavero, a person who feels better if someone else is embarrassed, right? Someone else stumbles, you feel good about yourself. Where's that from? It's a reinforcement of our sense of anochiyut. Now, it's a very powerful force. The Rav Yisrael Salamtik quotes here, writes, it's one of the most powerful latent forces that exists in the human being that operates on an unconscious level. And we could push it to the side. As we grow older, we're supposed to push it to the side as well, or keep it in its place, make sure it's only on the surface but doesn't necessarily penetrate, but nonetheless, it's very, very difficult. He quotes an interesting case that the Medrash has, Rashi quotes it. Why did Adam and Chava were told not to eat from the Eitz Hadas? Why did Chava give Adam to eat after she ate herself? So she should not die, and he'll live and marry someone else. What's the thought? It's all about her. That's a sense of anochiyut. not what's going to happen to him, the dangers that happen to him, but she thought of it entirely from her perspective. So the question is, why was a person given this powerful sense of self, this ego? There's no doubt great things can come from it, because from there comes our drive, our creativity, our desire to make our mark in the world. But nonetheless, it's a kli mesukan. It's a very dangerous vehicle, and if it's not used properly, it can destroy a person entirely. So one mitzvah, great mitzvah, that the Torah gives us to overcome our sense of anochiut is what? V'ahav l'recha kamocha. You should love your neighbors yourself. If you have to love your neighbors yourself, so right away that's going to diminish the amount of anochiyot a person can feel. Madisan eloch l'chaver chosavid. What's hateful to another, don't do. What's hateful to you, rather, don't do to another. Your measure of conduct towards the other is going to be what bothers you. On that level, human beings would be able to live very good lives, very virtuous lives. If all we tried to do was avoid doing to others things that bother us, it would be a much better world. But through that mitzvah, through the identification with the other, looking at the world through another, ki geirim heyisem eretz Mitzrayim, don't torment the ger, because you were geirim, you know what it's like. Look at the world through that prism. That's taking the ego from a positive perspective. So you see, you have, again, one thing, and it could be the source of tremendous agmas nefesh and self-centeredness and harm, or it could be the source of great virtue in contributing to others. So that's another example, some that you have on both realms. And he says, there was one practice that we're given in order to help us deal with this sense of anochiyut, and that's tefillah. Because tefillah involves submission to God. It's a recognition that the Creator is the one who gives us everything we have, even our sense of identity. So tefillah is hachna. It's an act of self-sacrifice, like karbanos, keneged karbanos, because we're really giving of ourselves. Things that build the ego can be positive, but by the same token, they can be harmful as well. And he quotes a famous story in the Gemara Tainis, Daf Chaf Amud Aleph, that the Daf Yomi will get to next week, about Rabbi Elazar Rav Shimon, Bar Yochai's son. He was coming from Migdal Gedor, from learning. He was riding his donkey, and he was very happy. He's along the banks of the river. He was extremely overjoyed. He was even arrogant. He was filled with Torah. All right. And what happens? He sees a guy, a very ugly person. The guy says to him, Shalom Alecha Rebbe. He didn't answer him. And all that Rabbi Elazar said to him is, Reka, empty one. Kama mechur oso ish. How is it possible someone could be so ugly? And he didn't mean in a personal sense, although I'm sure the guy took it that way. So the Gemara says he just meant it again as a scientist. How is it possible that someone could be so ugly? But it came from a bad place. It came from a place of extreme self-consciousness, self-centeredness. So the man answered him, Eini yodea, I don't know. Why don't you go tell my creator what an ugly vessel he created? That snapped Rabbi Elazar out of his mist, all right, out of his fog, and right away he apologized. He got off his donkey, he bowed before him, and the man refused to forgive him. The Gemara goes on. But Rav Dessler writes here that Torah itself can be a tremendous source of egocentricity, unless it's placed in the proper perspective. Because a person who's filled with Torah, as the Gemara goes on to say, it was a test, it was Eliyahu HaNavi, etc., but you see, Torah can fill a person with such a powerful sense of self that you can't live with other people anymore. A haughtiness, a conceit that renders normal life impossible. So Talmud Torah then also has to be placed in a context. And you see, Talmud Torah has those two dimensions as well. One which renders us the ideal servants of God, but if not handled correctly, it renders us as well very flawed creatures of God who nonetheless possess knowledge of Torah. And it's in that context that Rav Dessler brings this about the two drachim. There's a way of kvishas hayetzer, and there's a way of hafichas hara letov. So kvishas hayetzer is a little more difficult in this context because it involves Talmud Torah. So the way of Hashem here is hafichas hara letov. The Torah has a powerful light, right? And in that powerful light of Torah, it can transform any darkness into light as long as a person is open to it. I mean, if a person is learning Torah, certainly if you're just learning for the intellectual stimulation, it's not going to happen. If he's learning for kavod, to get the honor, the title, etc., it's not going to happen. But if a person is learning Torah in order to fill his mind with the ideas of God and the values of God, so then it shouldn't be possible for a person to be a Talmud Chacham, to be a Ben Torah, or I should say, be a Talmud Chacham and not be a Ben Torah. Ben Torah means a person who encompasses all the good values, all the ideals of Torah. So that is the pshat here as well. These types of opposites that can be harmonized, that's Yechido Shel Olam. Only God can do that. But God's placed us in a world where we have all these challenges, where you have one entity, and that entity can lead a person astray or intensify a person's commitments. That all depends on a person's bechira. Okay. Let's skip two for a moment and look at number three. Rabbi Yeshua de Sichni Meshem Rabbi Levi Amar. Arba Dvar Mietzara Meshiv Alehem. So again, the context paraduma, there are four things that the top left, that the Yetzahara challenges us on, attempts to argue against the Torah. Meaning, Yetzara here is our rebellious instincts that try to tell us that the Torah is not what it seems. The four things, the Yetzara Meshiv Alehem, Dechsib Em Chuka, four examples which the Torah used the expression Chok. One is Eishes Och, the brother of your, the wife of your brother, Vikilayim, Shatnez, Vesayir Mishtalayach, and the goat that's sent into the wilderness on Yom HaKippurim, the scapegoat, Upar Adum, in our case here. What is the issue? Eishes Och, Dichsiv, Ervas Eishes Ochicho, Uvalobonim, Yevama Yovo Aleho. Here's the case. You have one of the arayos, the prohibited relationships in the Torah, a man is not allowed to marry his late brother's wife. It's one of the arayos. You can't do it. Except in one context, loophole, yibum. If they had no children, then that's a mitzvah to marry, okay? Or, see, it's very strange. On the one hand, it's if they have a child, it's an iser kares, chayv misa, no child, then it's a mitzvah. Or, shatnez, you can't have wool and linen in the same garment, lo silbas shatnez, but sodom et tzitzis mutter. Tzitzis have to be made of ideally wool, and the tzitzis from linen. So you see, midaraisa, we don't do it anymore today, but midaraisa, you could have shatnez and tzitzis. So again, you have that conflict. In one context, in every context but one, it's asur, in one, it's mutter. The yetzer is meshev aleihem. And so mishtalech also, so the one who sends it out, the sar is designed to make us pure, pure meaning pure from sin, the one who sends it, so he becomes Tomei. And of course, the Paraduma, that's the classic one. Everyone involved in the Paraduma, in its preparation, becomes Tomei, right? Vehigufa mitaharis begadim. But if you sprinkle the waters of the Paraduma, that purifies garments. Uksib bachuka, it says in every case here, a chok. Is to say, in each area, there's a detail that doesn't seem to fit in. It's really the exception to the rule. What's the pshat? So it's like you said earlier, at a certain point, we have to surrender to the Das Elyon. As we understand each category, why it should be, even the in Yibum and the Kilayim, etc., you can understand all of it. Why, in certain cases, these combinations are bad, in other cases, the combination is good. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, we have to surrender to the Das Elyon, to what God says, because the details come from Him. to say that they're contradictions of which he was unaware in the Torah is, of course, risible, ludicrous. We wouldn't accept it. And that's a big problem, as we know, in the modern Orthodox world, especially this notion that there's no real surrender, that mitzvos have to accord with my sensibilities and gain my approval. Mitzvos have to conform to the secular value system, or they're not worthy. And if they don't conform to my sensibilities, so, you know, or else. I was reading last night an article that a young girl wrote, she's 17 now, unhappy, not in our community, unhappy with the way, you know, she can do nothing in shul, she wants to read the Torah, she wants the Elias, this, that. She doesn't like that there's any distinctions, because in the rest of the world there's no distinctions. I was wondering, I wrote to someone last night, why it's strange that no one's ever sought to explain to her that that's because the Torah is not based on the secular value system. It's its own value system. So why would you judge the Torah by a secular value system? It doesn't penetrate. But there was not, there was an explicit threat that if this doesn't change, then I'm leaving, I'm out, I don't want to be part of a system. Well, that's her choice also, but what's lacking in the entire conception, which is not unknown in our world, is this idea of surrender to God, to the Das Elyon. Surrender. We are the commanded, not the commander. There is a commander, capital C, but we're the commanded. There's an Adon, and we're the Avodim. And that idea is, for some strange reason, completely missing from Jewish education today in many circles. As if mitzvahs are just suggestions, options. You want to do it, we'll shower you with accolades. If you don't want to do it, so we understand it's not your fault. But I don't know where that comes from. You see from here, it's not like that. That's a chok. Yetzara meshev aleihem. The Yetzara is always encouraging us, always driving us to rejection of what we know to be what we should know to be true, the system that we were given, that we embraced at Sinai. If we can't accept that, then woe to us, or better said, woe to them, because they won't be part of the Jewish world, and those who are faithful to Torah will be. Okay, one of the episodes in the Torah this week is, of course, the fateful sin of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is always very hard to understand. Moshe and Aaron are told, V'dibartem el ha-sela, speak to the rock, extract the water from it, and instead Moshe comes, and Vayara Moshe siyado vayaches ha-sela b'mateo pamayim. He strikes the rock twice with his staff, and water comes out. And then God says to Moshe, it's Perek Chaf, Pasuk Yud Beis, very, very faithful pasuk. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aaron, Yan lo amantem bi l'aktisheni le'nei b'nei Yisrael, since you did not believe in me sufficiently to sanctify my name in the eyes of the children of Israel, lochein lo saviv sakol azel oretz asher nasati lahem. So you will not be able to bring the congregation into the land of Israel. Yan lo hamantem bi, since you did not have enough emuna. So look at number four. Yan lo emantem bi, v'chi lo amar dover kasha mizeh. That's the worst thing Moshe ever said to God. Moshe never minced words when he spoke to God. He had that luxury. B'chol beisi nemonu. Didn't Moshe say just a few weeks ago in Parshas Baloscha, Hatsonu v'koyi shachet lahem, watsa lahem, im es kol digeh hayom yaseif lahem, matzah lahem. God tells Moshe, when they complained about the lack of variety in the menu, which is mun, God says, go give them meat, give them fish. So Moshe says, where are you getting all this meat to feed 600,000 men every day? Where are you getting fish in the middle of the wilderness? All right? So there Moshe had no faith, and it's worse than what he did here. What did he do here? He didn't even say anything here. So why was Moshe not punished there? Because there is also not a Kiddush Hashem. L'maha davar dome, this is analogous to the following. L'melech shehoyah lo'ohev, a king had a friend. V'hoyah meges b'en l'vein ha'melech v'dvarim kashim. And the friend, when he was in private with the king, so he would, give the king some guff. He would chide him, he would criticize him, he'd rebuke him. They had an intimate relationship. He'd speak harshly to him. And the king didn't mind because they had that relationship. Liyom, every president should have that. I don't think the present one does, but every president should have a guy who, you know, talks tough to him behind the scenes. Liyomim Omad Veheges Bemamad Legionos. Came a time when this guy stood up in front of the king's legions and also spoke, rebuked the king, spoke harshly to him. Gazaro, Gazaro of Misa. He sentenced his friend to death. Because, what's the difference? Amar Afkach, Amar Lakadosh Baruch Hu. Lemosha, Harishona Shasisa Beini Levenecha. The first time, just the two of us. Achshav Keneged Rabim Iefshar. If it happens in public, you defy me. Laktisheni Leinei Bnei Yisrael. That I cannot overlook. A public Chil Hashem is worse. Well, public Chil Hashem. Is there a concept of a private Chil Hashem? What do you say? Is there a concept of private Chil Hashem? The answer is yes. It's an open mission of us in the fourth parak. Call a Machal Shem Shamayim B'Seser Nifrat Mimenu Bigalui. A person who defiles God's name in private, so he's punished in public for it. So what is this notion of a private Chil Hashem? Almost by definition we think of Chil Hashem in public. So Ram says he's punished in public before he can sin in public. He's still sinning in private. But nonetheless, how could that be Chil Hashem B'Seser in private? No one knows. Ah, you could say, well, it might become public, but let's say it doesn't become public. Nonetheless, Moshe's, when he spoke to Hashem in Baloscha, that didn't become public. No, we actually did. We read about it in the Torah all the time, once a year. Rabbi Chait explained that there are two types of Chil Hashem. There's one Chil Hashem that's Barabim, meaning, we'll discuss in a moment, but it means that God's name is desecrated in public. But there's another type of Chil Hashem, not we see like you're embarrassing God in the eyes of others, but very simply, to treat the Shem Shemaim like it's Chulin. Chulin means something that's Chol, that's profane, that has no substance to it. A person can do that in private as well. You treat God's name in private like it is chulin, so that is a Chil Hashem b'seser. It's not that other people will know about it. It's that you yourself deprecated the Shem Hashem in private, so therefore you'll be punished in public. Now, in public, the Chil Hashem means that a person acts in a way, a sin, of course, acts in a way that conflicts with or doesn't further God's objective. God has an objective for mankind, an objective that he wanted to accomplish through giving people the Torah. He wants a system to be known and admired throughout the world. So when a person acts in a way in public, a Jew acts in a way in public, in which that objective is frustrated, so that's a Chil Hashem. So in fact, there are two types. One is an action in which he makes God's name into chulin, into something insignificant in his private life, and the other is where he doesn't care about God's objective in the world. What's a Kiddush Hashem? It's the opposite. It means a person acts in a way where he does something that promotes the system, that engenders respect for the true ideas. So, look at the Mishnah. In fact, we read this Mishnah this week on Shabbos. Kol Machal Shem Shemayim V'Seser, a person who desecrates God's name in private, Nifrad Mimeno B'Galui, he's punished in public. So why should that be? Punish him in private. Because now the Chil Hashem would be greater if a person is punished in public. What's the answer? The answer is that one who sins in private, it means his value system is people, not God. That he worries about what people will say about him. He wants to retain or maintain a certain image in public, so he's afraid of sinning because then he'll lose face, he'll lose status. People will start to talk about him. So it's not the sin that he's committing, but rather his entire framework of reality is what people think. So Rabbi Chait said, that's why there's the onesh begolui. What the public punishment does, it breaks the value system. Because now people will now despise him because of the way he was punished. When the value system through which a person relates to God is what other people say, it's a path that does not lead to success, to anything good. It can't, because total distortion of the way we're supposed to live. Okay, turn the page. Look at number four. We're not going to get to all these today. Maybe just skip a couple of them. Number four, or Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, a very interesting approach. Again, because it's sin very hard to explain. And a punishment hard to explain. Other side.
But this is also...
Oh, yeah? The second type of four.
4-8.
That's right. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe. God said to Moshe. So again, what's the context here? God said to Moshe that he cannot enter the land of Israel. All right? He will not be able to enter the land of Israel. Lochein lo saviv es hakol hazeh el arat asher nasati lohem. So you will not bring this congregation, into the land that I gave them. So Chazal say, you know, the Torah never has a superfluous word. Here there are two. What does it mean hakol hazeh? This call? Hakol. Asher nasati lohem? To them, of course, to them. To who else? So what? To whom else? So why else? Why would it say it?
One of them going to die because of the Meraglim, and that one.
Moshe didn't have to die.
No, but Kahal Hazeh, opposed to.
Oh, sorry. So here's a factual point.
Because one group is going to die.
Right. The sad aspect of this story, it happened at the end of 40 years, not the beginning. But this happened just a few months before Moshe died. So he anticipated entering the land of Israel. Chukas spans 39 years from one story to the. We go from one story to the death of Miriam. No, it's not Mukhar, it's actually chronological.
This is chronological.
Uh-huh. This call Azeh is the call that arose after the Dor HaMidbar died. Moshe anticipated entering the land of Israel with them. It's only at the very end, at the end of 40 years, where this happened. He was told he's not entering the land. So what's a call Azeh? So God said to Moshe, how do you want to enter the land? In what way? How do you think you should enter the land? So, Mashal, the roa sheyotza liros tzona shomelech v'nishpes hatzon, the king who had a shepherd, and he went out to pasture the flock, and all the sheep were lost, taken captive, or lost, ran off. Bike sharel likonis lepaltarin shomelech. So the roa, the shepherd, then wanted to go to the palace of the king. If you enter now, what will people say? They'll say that you were the one who got rid of the sheep. You didn't even... it's your fault they were lost. So it's your fault they were lost. How can I have you in the palace? Afkan Amar LaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, Shivchachahu, your praise is Shotseiso Shishim Ribo Ukvarta Mamidbar. Your praise is that... you took 600,000 people out of Egypt, and then whole generation's gone, all buried in the wilderness. Vat machnis dar acher, you'll take another generation to the land. Achshav yomru, they will say, ein ledar hamidbar chelek olam haba. There is no share in the portion of the world to come for the generation of the midbar if you leave them behind. Ela tehei bitzidon. You will be at their side. You'll go with them. He went at the head of the people. You will not bring this call. You went out with them. You went out with them from Mitzrayim. You went with them at Olam Haba. Meaning their fate will be your fate as well, or maybe your fate will be their fate. What's the pshat? It means that it would be a bad reflection on Moshe's leadership if the people that he took out of Mitzrayim, they suffered one fate. They're the people on whom he made his reputation, of course, and he entered the land of Israel and the people did not. What kind of leader abandons his people? The leader always suffers the fate of the people, or at least is supposed to. How would it look if the Am is not Zoch Olam Haba and Moshe is Zoch Olam Haba? It can't be. Well, this is the Medrash. Well, no, it's the Torah that says you'll not take this call into the land, that you're going to die in the Midbar with with the others. It can't be, you can't have such a gap between the leader and the people, because if there is, it means he's not much of a leader, in which case, why are we lionizing him? Apropos of this, look at the next one. Number five, Hema Meimeriva, Mikana Talomed, Shemikedem Hayamisukon, Sheyeonesh Moshalamayim. From here we see these are the waters of Meriva. It was already prepared from long ago, from ancient times, that Moshe would sit on the water. Re'e Maksiv. Look what the Pasuk says in Parshas Lech Lecha already. Vayashuvu, Vayavo Ein Mishpat, Hi Kadesh. Alright, what is this reference? It's to the First World War, the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings. So the kings wage war against the King of Sodom, Amora, Atzoar, etc. And then it says the war went for 14 years, then they revolted. Vayashuvu, they went back. Vayavo Ein Mishpat, they came to Ein Mishpat, Hi Kadesh. And there they fought in the fields of the Amaleki and the Emori, who dwelled in Chatzetzon Tamar. Okay. Meaning what? So the Medrash continues, Ein Mishpatel Shel Moshe. This was the fountain of judgment for Moshe Rabbeinu. What do you know? Rashi says in Breishis, Ein Mishpat Hi Kadesh Al Shem HaAsid Shasid Moshe V'yar Li Shafet Shamal Iske Oso Ayin. Also, Ain, that Moshe and Aaron would in the future be judged because of this water, this fount, this spring. Vehem Mei Meriva. That's the Mei Meriva. Well, this is an interesting nut that we have to crack, okay? A lot of discussion in the Rishonim. The Ramban asks, for example, well, Kadesh is Kadesh Barnea. That's in the Midbar Tzin. It's not taking place Midbar Tzin. The Mizrahi and others justify Rashi, they're too Kadesh. Nonetheless, besides getting to those technicalities, what's the pshat? You see that Chazal, in a very, very ingenious but esoteric way, finds some type of thematic linkage between the War of the Kings that took place here, Vayavol Ein Mishpat Hi Kadesh, and Mishpatel Shel Moshe. So the question is, what exactly is that connection? What's the connection between the War of the Kings, in which Avram intervened and defeated them, and this sin of Moshe at Mei Meriva that Chazal decided to link? It's not so easy to understand. Any suggestions? Understand the question? All right, so I thought a few things. First of all, what was the whole purpose of this war, the First World War? It was to kill Avram Avinu. That was the first thing. In other words, it was to end Avram's opportunity of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Had Avram been killed, of course, then there would be no family of Avram. He had no children at the time. So therefore, it was designed to sever Avram's connection with the land of Israel. So now you hear the same thing happen here. Moshe's capacity to connect himself, attach himself to the land of Israel, and take the Jewish people therein was here severed because of the sin of Mei Meriva. So the attempt to destroy Avram failed, but the lingering effects, though, were that it destroyed Moshe's attempts. Why would Moshe be treated more harshly than Avram? So you see, that's something that the Chazal took up elsewhere, that Avram was always identified with God, Avram Ivri. Avram was seen as Nasi Elohim, whereas Moshe Rabbeinu was always criticized heavily, because when the Benos Yisro came, when he saved them at the well, when they were being tormented by the others, so their father said to him, the girls, what happened? Vatamarna ish mitzri tzilam yad haroim. An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. And Moshe didn't correct them, that he wasn't an Egyptian, he was a Hebrew. And for that, he's contrasted first with Yosef, who did say, Kigunov ganaf meretz ha'evrim, I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews. Yosef identified. Moshe did not identify. So therefore, he lost his chance. Okay, another point. I think there's also an aspect of chok to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael as well. That certain things happen that are unexpected, of course. I mean, the land is really based on that. Much of what happens cannot be anticipated. Here, Avram cleared the land of Nimrod and solidified his early chazaka in the land of Israel unexpectedly. The war came upon them unexpectedly. Whereas Moshe lost his rights to the land of Israel unexpectedly. It happened in this one place as well. And also, I would say, a basic truism, war always has unseen consequences. Whether it's World War I or World War II, any war, the Iraq War, any war always, almost never goes according to plan. It can't be. Even the Six-Day War, which is, remarkable to the point of miraculous in our own memory, so even that didn't go according to plan. I mean, things happened that were not expected there too, but nonetheless, if there ever was a perfect war, that was the perfect war. All objectives achieved within a week, and like we know, people have no patience in Israel, certainly, but even the rest of the world now, for wars that last more than a week. Because if it could be done in 1967, it should be done today also. Got to resolve every problem within a week. So things don't have to linger too long in the news cycle. But that's not reality. In any event, you see, I mean, it bears further analysis, but you see Chazal did draw this linkage between the fate of Avram and the War of the Kings, the fact that the War of the Kings took place in the same place, Ein Mishpat, and Moshe's sin that came later on, that in fact deprived him of the right to be in Israel. All right, one other point, we'll just look at the beginning of 8. Here you have at the end of the Sedra, or towards the end of the Sedra, one of the Shiros that we have in the Torah, sung in honor of the Be'er, the well of Miriam, Oz Yashir Yisrael, it's Perchav Aleph Pasuk Yizayin, Oz Yashir Yisrael, Asashir Azos, Ali Ve'er Enula, Be'er Chafur Sarim, Karun Nedive Ha'om, Vimchokek Mish'an Osam, Umi Midbar Matana, from the Midbar we got this Matana, the gift. The gift, of course, is Torah. Umi Matana Nachliel, Umi Nachliel Bamos, etc. So here the Medrash says, Dabar Acher, Loma Nitna Bamidbar. Why was the Torah given to us in the Midbar and not in Eretz Yisrael? Why in the wilderness? Number 8. She'ilu nitna lahem ba'aretz. If the Torah was given to us in the land of Israel, hoya hashevet she'nitna b'tchumo omer, the tribe in which the Torah was given in its region would say, ani kodem ba. The Torah is really mine. I take a proprietary interest in it. It's mine first. Lekach nitna b'midbar she'yi hakol shavin ba. So the Torah was given in the Midbar, so everyone should be equal. No one should say that the Torah belongs to me more than anyone else. What is Chazal saying? Of course, I don't have to do anything more than repeat their words. She'yi hakol shavin ba. When it comes to Torah, everyone has a claim to Torah. Everyone can study Torah. It's the property of all Klal Yisrael. It's Morasha Kehilas Yaakov. It's the heritage of all of Israel, the entire Jewish people. No person, no individual, no group, no tribe can say the Torah is more mine than anyone else's. Anyone wants to wear the crown of Torah, so he should go and put on the crown of Torah. It's open to everyone. Mind you, of course, the crown of Torah requires faithful study, requires diligence, requires the ability to be submissive to the Ratzon Hashem, requires humility as well. But if a person has that, wants the Torah, so the Torah belongs to everyone. She'yu akol shavim ba. Everyone is equal. Every Jew is equal when it comes to his or her share in the Torah. That's why the Torah was given to us, where no one could say, it's really mine, because in my territory, the Torah was given. Okay, I thank you all very much. So we're on hiatus now until after the summer. Okay, enjoy.
Thank you.
Thank you.